But think about that day where you're sitting across the table and it's like, are you going to have leverage or are you not? Are you going to have some money for your kids and their kids? Or are you going to have everything pretty much, you know, you're going to lose everything?
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields, and this week we've got a very special guest, LMC, one of the best storytellers in the game on YouTube. How you doing, LMC?
I'm good. You can call me Luke, by the way, too. LMC is just short for my initials. Also stands for Let's Make Creations, but my name is spelled L-U-C.
All right. Well, it's a breaking news. Kellen, how are you doing?
Doing really well. Really excited to talk to Luke. Really excited to dive into, you know, storytelling, the cannabis industry. And, you know, it's just really refreshing to have a diehard West Coaster back on the show. You know what I mean, Brian? How are you?
That's fair. But I do appreciate Luke's storytelling. And I did see recently we've had a lot of New York documentaries come out. So I think we can get some exposure on what's going on there and maybe some of the history on what's going on. So, Luke, for our listeners unfamiliar about you, can you give a background about yourself and how you got into the cannabis space?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I've been involved with cannabis pretty young. I mean, like really 14 on to like 20, 22, 23. Worked in the traditional market, the medical market up here in Seattle, Washington. And then, you know, I happened to kind of lose everything in a certain way and had kind of rebuild. And I was looking for a job, ended up getting an I-502, a job with an I-502 brand, and started working in that company. And I just started to see a lot of the Washington state markets, like no one really knows about it. Really, we're kind of tucked up here in the corner. You know, it's funny, it's kind of similar regulations in New York, but it's a really, really tough market, especially for brand. I mean, like the retailers run everything. And so, I don't know, I was very frustrated, honestly. And I think I took a lot of that frustration. I wanted to help people as well as myself, right, to learn. And so I started just making these kind of different YouTube videos just to like educate people and more so myself. And then it kind of led into, you know, I did like 1,000+ videos. I try to do 1,000+ like different new, like just really quick content, like on Zoom where I like review different news content or media, you know, different strategies I saw, you know, just by analyzing different companies. And then that led, you know, into me finally, you know, I think I tried to do 1,000 different videos in the first year of my YouTube. This is right at the beginning of COVID or the pandemic. Can we say that now? Yeah, I was crazy back then. You had to like kind of not say that. But anyway, I got to like 900 and like something videos. And I then just, you know, I kind of realized I got tunnel vision. It wasn't really working smarter. I should have been working smarter, not harder. And so anyway, I kept kind of trying to just experimenting with different formats. And then I finally put this video out on a whim, kind of a video essay on Burner and the Cookies. It's called Burner and the Cookies Cannabis Empire. And then that video ended up blowing up, actually. And it was like, you know, I was like, oh, this is the direction I should go. And so I started then from there, went to Ivan and the Jungle Boys. And then it just kind of progressed from there. And I realized, you know, with YouTube, especially, you know, I watch a lot of different types of news, kind of like politics, a bunch of different, you know, different genres that have kind of quicker formats. And I realized, you know, with cannabis, the format that I was meant to do was more, even though I have a lot of ADD, even though I'm terrible with like, you know, sitting down and trying to like, you know, diligently work on something for 6 hours straight, which is now which I try to do now, but still hard. I think that I was meant to kind of more, you know, kind of tell story, be a storyteller, right? Whereas I was kind of doing much more of like a reporting, you know, reporting and analyzing. I think that storytelling brings in, you know, the masses. I think it brings in people that aren't even interested in this, like they're not even involved with cannabis at all, but they like the story. And that's what I think it brings in people. And then the people that are in the cannabis industry that are involved, I think they like the analysis that I do at, you know, kind of during throughout the storytelling. And so I think it brings in kind of two parties to that. Sorry, a little bit long-winded answer, but I appreciate that.
No, I think that's perfect. And I think one of the things that's most intriguing is that cannabis has always been one of those where there's stories that are not really told publicly, and a lot of people don't want to be found. And I think some of the things that I found most fascinating is that you can kind of blend the mixture of getting some of the underground information that maybe isn't so popular for most of the mainstream industry, and then bringing that to the light. So I guess my first question would be, how do you develop that trust and that relationship with the individuals you're portraying? Because a lot of them might not want that publicity. And then do they want to be shown a specific way, or how much autonomy are you given?
Yeah, the trust part is a big thing, especially with like a lot of the OGs. You know, these are people that for, I mean, shit, 30, 40 years were like hardcore. Like if you were born in the 90s, late 80s, and you know, you were involved with the traditional market, you may like think, I mean, yeah, there's probably a different, you know, I mean, I've, you know, number of different security measures taken. But I mean, imagine the people born in the 76, like, these are people that are taking extreme caution because they could get, you know, 20, 30, you know, plus years for a plant, which is crazy. So, yeah, building that trust is important with the OGs for sure. I think as time goes on and we're kind of thrust into this, you know, digital age where everyone's kind of, you know, realizing even the people that are older, which is, you know, impressive because it's kind of hard to, you know, adapt when you're older, right? But they're realizing that, like, you have to really build your platform online. It's the future. It's either adapt or die. And storytelling and telling your story is important, you know, not only for, you know, yourself, but I think to help others as well. So I think it's, but yeah, so building that trust is important. I also think though, you know, my body of work, it kind of compounds on itself a little bit. Like they've seen other work of mine potentially. And so then they go, you know, oh, okay, I trust this guy, you know, but at first, yeah, it was definitely tough. It still is, you know, I always tell people every time I do a story on them or, you know, however it may be, but I always tell them, thank you for letting it, for trusting me with your story. Cause I think it's a very important thing to, you know, they're trusting you with your story, and it's your job to, you know, make sure that not only, you know, their story is told right, but that the audience is getting the authentic, you know, authentic, true, you know, they're getting value from that as well. And so what was the last part of that question too?
Just how do you balance? And I think you did a perfectly job of explaining that, the balance of the trust, but also portraying the information in a way that's fair and resembles it from a standpoint that they can be proud of. Because again, like these people, most of them have been underground for a while. And it's not like people can Google search some of these questions and answers that you're providing.
100%. Yeah. And I definitely get some comments, you know, being like, oh, you're dry. Like it's funny that those are hilarious to me. Cause it's like, at this point, people need to realize the game has been cracked open. I mean, back like growing up, like I think, you know, like a small amount of people knew how to send packs through the mail. Now everyone and their mama knows how to. I literally was featured in an Esquire article about how to like send little small amounts of cannabis through the mail, like safely. Like it's mainstream now. So it's like, you know, that stuff's cracked open. But then what gets it more interesting, I think, is that people need to realize that, you know, as long as enough time's gone by, you know, and you know, that person thinks, like, I've had multiple stories, people coming to me, multiple, like, I have many of these actually, like probably like 6, 7, 8, 9 different stories like this, where it's just, I tell them it's too soon. Let's just put this on the shelf right now. We're going to come back to it when it's the right time, because it's not safe, in my opinion, for, you know, it's too current. And I never, ever obviously want to have, you know, anybody ever get, you know, in trouble or anything like that because of my content. That you know, that's not what I'm trying to do here. And it's, you know, it's much more of a preservation thing. And I think that, you know, because people are, I'm getting hit up now more by people that are, it's more current day, because people are trying to like, they're realizing the importance of telling their story, and they're kind of, and there's some of these people that are understanding this, that they're in the moment, they're kind of living out their story in the sense of that, you know, whatever the traditional market operations are, but they're almost they're a little ahead of themselves, right? Where I'm like, okay, this is a little too soon. Like, and there's a couple of times I've walked on the tightrope a little bit, for sure. But yeah, I never want to get into trouble. But no, yeah, it's a balance for sure.
Speaking of stories, I want to kind of hear the story of like how you landed Burner, and right before you kind of released that first true storytelling episode, did you have a feeling it was going to kind of hit? Like, kind of talk us through that whole like process.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, for anybody out there that's looking to get approval from like someone that's like a major public figure. You know, I remember, I'm sure many people I tried to contact Brent. I tried to contact all these big people. And why would they respond to me? What's the reason for them? They don't have any reason to respond to me. I have no, you know, they've got hundreds, thousands of people hitting them up. Right. And so really in that process, right. I mean, I just analyzed, I remember a baseball coach always used to tell me, he's like, just observe. And like, you can learn so much from observation. I know it's a simple kind of obvious thing, but it's true. And I would just observe, analyze. And there's a few of my videos. There's actually a decent amount of my videos in the first year of my high design series where I couldn't get a hold of these people, but that never stopped me. It's never going to stop. But it also means I have to do a lot more extra research to make sure that, you know, what I'm saying is true. And I've gotten some stuff wrong for sure, but I've also gotten a lot of stuff right from my observation. But so going back to the burner video, I just luckily he had a lot of information. He had his own documentaries on there. He actually claimed Empire, his music distribution company, they claimed that video and took all the ad revenue from it. It's kind of bullshit because I thought it was fair use, but no worries. I don't really care at all about that. It was one of the most important like things that happened to me in terms of this career that I'm in. But yeah, I just told the story. If you watch it, there's a lot of errors in it. You know, I stumble. It's pretty sloppy. It took me a decent amount of time, but I think I realized, like, you know, with the direction I was going with my content, I realized I have to look at quality and I have to put in, you know, I can't get that instant gratification. I need that delayed gratification, because that's where the best results are going to happen. And did I know it was going to blow up? I kind of did, but not, you know, it was the first time I tried it. So I think I kind of did, but I'm trying to remember my mindset at that point. I mean, I think it did pretty well right away, but, you know, at the end of the day, like, I think as long as for people that don't want to, you know, I don't want to go too far into this, but like, you know, with Burner, it's funny, like, I tried to get a hold of him for like, you know, a while. It was kind of a goal of mine because, you know, I looked up to him. I listened to his music in high school, you know, all that. And, I think I had positive intentions. You know, I think he might have, you know, I kind of was like, oh, why didn't he give me like the, come on, that'd be kind of dope. Give me like the retweet on this video. I kind of hyped him up a little bit on that video. But I realized though, he didn't give me that until later on. The way that we actually first started talking, like actually with each other, was him dissing me on Twitter. But, you know, now we're like acquaintances, not like, you know, homies or anything, but we're acquaintances. But yeah, I think with media though, it's just like, the best networking skill, the best networking tactic, in my opinion, has been just creating content about people that you look up to and that you like what their business, acumen has been. Like, I've been hit up by, like, if you can't get a hold of them, do that. And I guarantee you there's a great chance you're going to be able to eventually, you know, be able to conversate with them. Sorry, I know I've got all over the place.
No, you're right there. And I think the important thing that you said that I want to harp on is that this wasn't the first video that you did, right? You said you did about 1,000 videos, and those repetitions is what put you in a chance to even have the opportunity for one of your videos to absolutely pop, because you had to have failed a million different ways. And sure, putting his name in that and the information is really well done, but I think it's the continued growth that you've shown, which I kind of adhered to that trust that you built with the audience and with the others that understood what you're doing. But one of the areas I do want to highlight is that some of your stories you're telling, though, are little more challenging, like talking about the Glass House one, right? Which was very eye-opening for me because, sure, we all recognize how massive their facility is, but with what's happening on, opening up that perspective is a bolder way to a big powerhouse, exactly like you laid out. So were there any opportunities, if you can speak about that, where the people spoke out and said, hey, we really don't want you to do this? And if so, you know, how does that back and forth work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one thing I want to say really quick about, you know, what you just said right before that is just for anybody out there, just, I realize, fail fast. Don't be afraid to fail and just fail fast. Don't make the same mistake over and over. But, you know, the more you fail in different ways, that means you're learning. But to go back to your question, right?
I've definitely, I grew up kind of, you know, somewhat in the streets, right? You know, I had different situations where, you know, you're in the traditional market. And so, you know, you got to stay in your ground. You kind of have to be tough, but it's also a kind of a different mental toughness, I think, when you bring into the legal area and you're now talking with like PR, you know, that are threatening you, like, we're going to sue you. We're going to investigate you. I guess so for like the Glass House story, you know, it's weird. I've turned into kind of I call myself kind of a journalist. I don't really think I'm a journalist. I mean, I think I do journalistic
things for sure. I've done some pieces that are definitely journalism, in my opinion. But, you know, I call myself more of a storyteller, like a hybrid, I guess, of the two. And, I didn't go to school for journalism. You know, I kind of been learning this as I go. And getting, like, for example, like the Glass House story. That's a story where, you know, I was told, like, you know, I should have, you know, I will admit, like, the Glass House story, I did hit them up for comment because I didn't really know, like, what were they going to say to me? Like, I knew what they were going to say to me about this, and I knew what they were doing. I mean, I knew the whole story. I mean, I've been hearing about this I have stories that I've been, like, you know, percolating or bubbling up, you know, a year and a half before, right? And so, like, the Glass House story, it's like, hey, you know, I probably, you know, from a journalistic standpoint, you know, I'm learning on the fly. You know, I probably should have reached out for comment. At the same time, I almost knew what they were going to say, and I didn't even want to, you know, waste my time with that, which, you know, I'm open for, you know, criticism on that and constructive criticism, because I know, you know, probably, you know, if I do a follow-up video, I definitely don't want to have their point of view. I don't know if they're going to want to talk to me or not, but that story, they're more of a representation, in my opinion. And also the fact that, you know, they're on the cover of MJ, you know, Biz magazine, being like, you know, the more, like, the enforcement wants you to know, like, how to stay compliant. What? Like, that stuff's egregious, right? And so they're a representation of, like, probably, like, 20 other companies in California that are massive legal, massive greenhouse spaces that are just flooding the market. And it's going to happen. You know, I think you're not going to stop it. But I kind of want to use this story as a, you know, a little bit of, like, a warning to the little, you know, outdoor, you know, farmers, right? That, hey, you're not going to win with this business model, because you're trying to win on scale outdoor. I mean, you're going to get crushed. Like,
yeah,
you're going to get destroyed. I mean, I worked out in Eastern Washington, you know, like, it's those people, like, I worked out in Tenasket, Okanagan, you know, County, bro. Like, there's, like, one or two of these cultivation grows left, and there used to be, like, 10, 20. It's really just, yeah, I try to use the storytelling and those kind of stories as a warning to people. It's like, hey, you need to change up the business model. Maybe you need to adapt. You need to pivot. Right. You know, because that's where I really started out my whole YouTube for, was the small, you know, the aspiring entrepreneur like myself, the small, you know, small business owner, the little guy. Like, you know, the little guy is really, like, you're going to most 90% of these people are going to get crushed, you know, but that 10% that is really educated, that, you know, threads the needle, finds the cracks in the system and grows, you know, from those cracks and potentially into something amazing. There's going to be some of those people. And so that's why I think my content, you know, is really designed to help those people, as well as, you know, kind of spread awareness.
How do you balance when you're choosing certain stories to tell, how do you balance it being, like, a good story that is relevant versus it being a story that could be significantly impactful for some of these small businesses? Are there times where you're like, hey, this story is relevant, but I want to actually publish this story first because it's going to have more impact on these small businesses and help them make decisions and make them more aware of kind of what's going on outside their purview?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a really, really good question. You know, it's a balance between figuring out, because you're kind of, like, you're asking, right, like, because that's a small niche group of those small business owners, it's not in my incentive structure as a YouTuber necessarily to be spending resources, time, all that stuff on those kind of videos. And, you know, it's a balance of the two, because this whole media business, you have to, you know, make it run, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to generate views, obviously. But, you know, yeah, I have done plenty of videos where it's very niche specific. I mean, I did a video, for example, this is right before New York legalization, and I did a whole breakdown on how the game is kind of rigged in New York. And it's, like, a really, like very, very hardcore, like, analytical, you know, it's taking a lot of experience from, you know, what I saw in Seattle and Washington, because there's very similar regulatory systems there. And it's actually, you know, most regulatory systems are, like, Colorado or Cali, but Washington and New York are the same. Anyway, I did that kind of video, and it's really weird, actually. It got taken down, like, a week before this past 420, you know, New York legalization. And it's a little, I'm not trying to go off conspiratorial, but it's like, I mean, this broke this down to the T, where it's like, you know, this is how you're getting played. This is what you need to look at, you know, for the retailers, you need to look at, you know, securing the land. There's only a limited amount of spots for the retail spots. That's going to be location, like a bunch of different things. I need to go find the video, because like when YouTube takes it down, they take it down. You can't get the video. You can't download the video like you usually do. And I need to find that video, because I need to put that up on Instagram or Twitter or somewhere, because it's, I mean, like a lot of people, like, you know, it only got like, it got age restricted right away. I got like 4,000 views on it, but there's a lot of people in the comments being like, hey, thank you. This was, you know, this is very informative. You know, and I've done other videos kind of like that, that are more like that. But at the same time, I think that if you can balance the storytelling with those kind of elements of helping the small business, that's the best of both worlds. Now, it's important for the audience to know how to find those things. There's a lot of stuff that I like. I'm a big fan of hip hop rap. There's a lot of subliminal stuff. There's a lot of stuff threaded in that some people may catch, some people don't. But, you know, there is always, like I said, I think in my opinion, there's always different things that a small cannabis business owner can learn in my videos, you know, because I'm an aspiring one myself. And that's my mindset as well. I do it like from the mindset of a cannabis, you know, aspiring cannabis business owner, as well as a consumer and a citizen, I guess, as well.
I think the part that always surprised me is your videos get massive views, and a lot of these cannabis companies are looking for ways to advertise and connect with consumers. And I think sometimes they're not putting the piece of the puzzle together and recognizing that, like, working with someone like yourself who can attract various eyeballs from that brand stability or credibility standpoint is helpful for national exposure. So have any of these bigger public companies, let's say one that's seen some of the views you've done, reached out and say, hey, Luke, we're interested in having you help us tell our story, and we want to bring you in from a marketing stance on how to articulate that to consumers?
You know, funny enough, not really, actually, as many, like, not like, you know, you're absolutely right with in terms of like, not, you know, I think my videos and the storytelling, I think it's one of the best possible marketing strategies you could possibly use for expansion into other states, you know, getting your name out there. But like, I mean, I have a whole criteria, and maybe it's just because like people watch my comment and they're like, oh, we probably, I mean, you know, sorry, let me get back to, I guess, what I'm trying to say. So the criteria, I guess, when people I work with is, one, I'm not going to work with any big business, like big, like MSO, honestly, in the sense of the, you know, and I'm not trying to hate on the MSOs. It's just, they have such an upper hand right now. I would rather help the small business. So my criteria really is like, you know, you've got a great story, you know, you're, you know, not a big MSO, you're, you know, small business, mom and pop, you know, to a certain degree. And it's the right time. You know, there's some companies I have documentaries that are on the shelf that aren't ready yet, because I realized this is not as, you know, I want this story to fully play out, and I want this, you know, video to, like, you know, be as effective as possible in getting the name out on the company. So, you know, like I said, I think this is really like a really, really, really underlooked set, like marketing tactic slash, you know, getting your name out there, because storytelling, it allows for people to, first of all, understand who this company is, who's behind this company. It allows people to see themselves in those people that are in the company. That's a big thing. It allows people to see, you know, the key to, I realized with the storytelling, is to showcase someone's hardships and how they overcome them. It really, like, just to kind of simplify it a little bit, right? Because people love to see that. And I think it's important to show that, because one, you're showcasing problem solving, right? You're showcasing, but you're also showcasing that, yeah, this shit is hard. And that, you know, and I think people can relate with that. And you know, I mean, I've gotten definitely like a few videos where people hit me up and they're like, dude, I was like crying at the end of that video, which that's kind of what we aim to do here. You know, it's not always the case. You know, it depends also to, you know, I guess, what's your personal connection to it? Because I think there's a lot of people that have like nostalgic sentiment that, you know, they see themselves in it, right? That's when you really hit the sweet spot, is when, you know, like I saw this Jungle Boys 3-minute video that they put out like 5 years ago or whatever. And it's just like, it doesn't even say a single word besides like, it's all storytelling done. You know, it's kind of featuring like, you know, younger Ivan, you know, the founder, one of the founders of the Jungle Boys. And it's like, I remember watching it back in 2018 when it came out. Right. And I remember just by the end of the video, like crying, like literally crying. And I'm, you know, I wasn't even really a grower, but from the growing to the distribution, you know, all that stuff and all those hardships, it hits home. And so, and that's, by the way, whoever I get a, I got a hit, I can see who, what company did that 3-minute video, but it's some of the best storytelling I've ever seen. They don't say a single word, but yeah, I guess going back though, like I said, it's a very undervalued asset in my opinion for, you know, for you to tell your story. Cause this, you know, people need to understand who you are. That's why, you know, and I, from a media standpoint, I study the hip hop kind of landscape of, you know, media. And I've, you know, I've realized that there is, to build out a healthy, strong, vibrant media ecosystem, we need to have an infrastructure, a baseline, a foundation of knowledge for the general public so that we can have more and more nuanced conversations. You know, for example, like, how do you know, like you're watching a video and someone's talking about, or you're watching a Snoop Dogg interview, right? And he's talking about, you know, Tupac interacting with Nas. Now, the audience doesn't understand, they wouldn't understand that story that he's telling in that manner unless, you know, they knew Nas and Tupac, which they obviously did. So there needs to be a lot of storytelling for these individuals, these people, these companies, so that as time goes on, the general public and the audience for this niche can understand these really nuanced, complex situations, right? And we can have commentators and different new types of media personalities that can have new types of formats that make sense to the general public. Does that make sense? I'm kind of...
Yeah, I think that's perfectly said. And I think storytelling, it kind of encapsulates when you make people feel something, they connect with them. And I think that's the ability for storytelling to be so powerful, is that it's the oldest way, right, we as humans communicate with each other is via storytelling. And that feeling that you elicited in some of your documentaries, I think you humanize the individuals and you demonstrate the challenge that they overcome. And you also give them a personality. For some of these people that are fans of the cannabis industry, they aspire to Ivan of Jungle Boys or Burner, and they've never really felt that close. And I think you do a good job of communicating those values and bringing them to life on the screen.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, the humanization aspect is a key component to that for sure. You know, the thing about big corporations is, like, they're considered by the government as people, right? I mean, that's the funniest part about it. But
pretty cool.
They're not people though. Yeah, they're pretty cool. They're not people. And like, you know, and like, we're in this era now that everything is on camera now. We're in the digital era and people want to get to know the person. That's why, I mean, look at Elon Musk, right? He showed a lot of, you know, whether you like, hate him or, you know, love him. He showed, we know the kind of personality he has, right? And there's going to be people that are going to not like that personality. There's people that are going to love that personality. But the point is, we know his personality. And, you know, it's become a marketing tactic, literally. Like, you know, it can be a little bit volatile. And so, you know, at times, because it's, you're kind of a little bit cult of personality, you know, a little top down, that can be, you know, a little detrimental potentially long term. But yeah, the humanization aspect is really key. And that's also another component with a lot of these MSOs is, and I think a lot of them have personalities, but I think because they come from the corporate world in other industries, that it's hard for them, you know, they're told, you know, you don't, you know, they're media trained. They don't really, you don't want to showcase your really real personality. I mean, I'll say that that's the full case, but they're really, you know, they're stuck in a narrow box. And I think that could be a little bit, in this new era, actually a disadvantage.
When you're humanizing these individuals, right? I mean, we're talking cannabis, right? Which has a stigma, and the type of person that typically has been in the cannabis industry in the traditional market for a long time really enjoys consuming cannabis, right? And consuming cannabis on video and then publishing it on the internet tends to not be the most liked video by YouTube and all these other entities, right? They tend to limit that. So like, have you found like that? Is there like a really like a Goldilocks zone where you're like humanizing these individuals, but you're also like selectively only incorporating certain amount of like cannabis use and those kind of things? Because talk us through like that balance. Because I think that that's also where you see this huge disconnect with a lot of the culture and these MSOs, because like you just said, the executives of these MSOs are like taught that that's a PR nightmare. You don't want to do this. You don't want to act that way. You can't show this face in public because it could kill our stock price. So like, that sounds like such an interesting, like Goldilocks balance that you have to, the game you have to play at least.
It does. Yeah. I mean, I mean, exactly. For those CEOs, I mean, it's tough because they're told everything you know to do. Sorry, remind me the very beginning of the first question. How? the very beginning. So no, you're diving. I know what you're saying. That's what I remember now. How do you balance out the cannabis use with that? Yeah, I think first of all, I will say this: when I first started making content, right, you know, I started to look around the space and I saw a lot of these, you know, kind of influencers, right, quote unquote, that were all about consumption. Right. They would be smoking on, you know, on camera, they're consuming on camera. That's kind of like their vlog, you know, and I'm not gonna lie. Maybe it was a little bit of my envy or jealousy and or I also kind of was like, what, why do people watch this? This is like, you know, this is just people smoking on camera, you know, and I think it was a little bit, you know, a number of different things, but I, you know, self, you know, analyzing myself, I kind of realized like that's, you know, I shouldn't judge that. And I honestly, like, I get it now because there was, I was talking to somebody about this. I think it was this woman named Ariana who used to work for the WeTube. But the thing about like the people that are doing like consumption based content, while, yeah, you're right. You think YouTube really likes to see a bunch of influencers consuming on like that's their number, that's like what their content is. No, it doesn't really help the progression of how YouTube and other corporations see cannabis. I'm not going to lie. It does not really help. But at the same time, for the viewer, right? Ariana, I remember saying, she's like, the thing about a lot of these people that are online smoking weed is that there's millions of people around the world that don't have anybody else to smoke with. They don't have anybody to consume with. And so they consume with this person they're following. And it's like, oh, okay. That, and it makes sense. And it's also, you know, it's just part of the media ecosystem for sure. Now that's for kind of more that, you know, and so, and shout out to all those people. I think we're also moving into an era though, more of like education now. It was less about just like viral smoke on, you know, camera. It's more like, it's still a little bit of that for sure. But I think we're moving into like the edutainment, which I think is, I'm part of that kind of new era coming in where it's educational, but it's also entertainment to, you know, a certain degree as well, storytelling. Now going back, I guess, to the balance of the Goldilocks balance. I mean, you don't have to be smoking like on camera, you know, it's really just storytelling and showcasing that you have that authenticity, you have that history in cannabis. You've really, that, and that's another, like, that's kind of the criteria points is like, I try not to like, you know, there needs to be a story there and there needs to be a background of, you know, your love for this plant. Because at the end of the day, if you don't have that, what story am I going to tell? Like, you know, like, you know, I think that there's, you know, I'm definitely looking into moving into more like doing kind of the storytelling document, you know, documentarian slash, you know, video essay format in other industries as well. Because I think there's a lot of value in it. But, you know, I think, yeah, sorry.
What video did you think should be more popular, but isn't?
Should be more pop. That's what you guys are. Yeah, let me look at my phone real quick. There's a few. I got a bone to pick with.
I love that answer.
There's one that like, there's a few that I'm like, I was so sure. I was like, this is going to do well. And that's what people need to realize too, is like, you are in the bubble. Don't think that everyone around the world like thinks like you are and are interested in what you are. Like I was, you know, some mentor, you know, shout out to Fletcher from Archive and a couple other people I've talked to about this. But, you know, if you think about it, there's really like, In like maybe North America, people like, you know, us three that are like really into the cannabis industry, like we are, you know, not only working in it, but like enthusiasts, like we are really into it. There's probably less than like 50,000 people in the United States that are like us, if that, right? Now there's the, you know, that are like really like, we're weed, political nerds, business nerds, all those things, right? There's not that many of us. And so you got to realize, okay, and that's what I did, you know, I kind of started to realize over time, that's why you have to bring in the storytelling element to make the other, you know, other portion come in. But going back to your question, let me look up, so I'm just going to search, I'll see real quick the videos. I mean, man, there's a few that really pissed me off that they didn't go.
Is there any, like, as an artist, I've heard like certain artists are like, oh, I love this song, but it just didn't hit. Where they're like, is that also like certain videos?
I'm looking up right now. Yeah.
It's the title or the thumbnail?
Kraft, the Kraft Farmer documentary. Okay, that's one. That's a huge one. That was an hour long.
Why?
Probably the most produced. Yeah.
Why did you love it that you don't think like it landed?
It didn't land because it got age restricted right off the bat. And then once you know it, for anybody that knows YouTube, like once they age restrict it, it's an automatic, like it's unofficial just killer of your video. It's got 46,000 views, but that video, in my opinion, you know, it should have some more, I think, because that video, you know, shout out to Lance from Craft Farmer. That video, he's just a natural storyteller. And I think, you know, I worked with one of his video people at the time, you know, shout out to Ian, by the way, we shot it together. That one, that one was amazing. His story is, it's insane. And I was really, I mean, and it was hourly, you know, that took me 6-7 months, right? 7-8, you know, took me a while to do that documentary. You know, I was working on other stuff. I wasn't like consistently working on it like 6 months straight, but you know, it took me a while. And it, you know, I was really, really proud of that work. That was definitely one for sure. By the way, that's a really good question you guys are asking. What else is there? I kind of wish I did one. It's Rap Smart as Entrepreneur. It's like an analysis of Nipsey Hussle's story and how he was, you know, pretty amazing, independent entrepreneur, business mind that had, you know, I've been following Nipsey forever, his music, but I also followed his business acumen. And, you know, I think it's just because my channel is not music oriented. It's not like, you know, hip hop business oriented necessarily. So it didn't do well. Plus, I think it might have gotten age restricted. That's definitely one. How bribery in the cannabis industry works. 1 year ago, it's got 9,000 views. That's definitely one. I wish had some more views for sure that I'm a little frustrated on. The archive genetics one. These are ones that just got age restricted too, right? Definitely, that's a little frustrating. That one should have more, in my opinion.
A lot of time it is timing, right? And I think you encapsulated that perfectly. That sometimes it's just about the timing. And for even for Kellen and I, we feel the same way. It's like sometimes we have conversations with individuals and we think they're spot on for what we think would be beneficial for our audience, and it just takes a hard right, and you wonder, you know, timing, what it could be. And I think that's part of the game we play, of just like continuing to put things out there. And as I think pseudo content creator, as we similar ours, we sometimes feel exactly like that, and always wonder, and like the guys, like what could happen. So expanding on that, has there been a time where you were doing some research, like you were saying, like 8 or 9 months you're working on something and you were like following a strain or a person, and you actually saw the rise when they were underground to a point where you knew in your mind, like, this guy's going to blow up or this strain is going to be everywhere?
Yeah. Okay. So this one that's another great question. You guys love this. This one's interesting. So David from Preferred Gardens, shout out to Preferred Gardens, right? I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that. I think like he was just at that perfect timing. Well, you know, so the High Design series I started. So it went Burner, Ivan Jungle Boys, and then they went David Preferred Gardens, right? And this was really the first person that come to me and contacted me. And I just started talking with him, right? And so the Burner one, I never got to talk to Burner. I got to actually interview Ivan, because he reached out when I put out a trailer. So I got to interview him and get the story, you know, the detailed story on that. And then the second kind of, you know, time I got to actually, you know, started to actually talk to the person was in the third ever episode of High Design, was with David and Preferred Gardens. And I mean, it's great. I mean, he's in now multiple different states. He was, you know, he's crushing it everywhere. If you guys haven't seen that video, go check it out. But like I said, I talked to him when he hit me up. And I had a lot of people, because the Jungle Boys had posted me on Instagram. I was starting to get hit up by a lot of people. And, you know, I had a great conversation with Dave, and I realized, like, man, this guy is actually like an amazing person just in general. There's a lot of scumbags, to be honest, in this industry. There's a lot of like really fucking shitty people, as you guys know. And he's the exact opposite of that. He is one of the very few people in this industry, very few, that I don't know a single person that could talk shit, like, that has a problem with him. Like, I mean, everyone in this industry has someone that doesn't like, you know, for this or stupid reasons, right? Or maybe real reasons, right? But never, like, there's really no one out there that, like, doesn't have, like, one or two haters, except for, I mean, I'm sure there probably are some out there at this point, getting bigger and bigger. But, I mean, I've never heard a bad thing about anybody's ever said about David and Preferred Gardens in general. So, you know, so going back to that question, though, you know, that video blew up, did like 150,000 views. And, you know, after that video, he moves into Florida, right? He was already kind of percolating before. But I think what my video did is, I think it helped, you know, throw a little gasoline on the fire that was already there. I mean, he had all the tools and he was already there. I just kind of helped shine a little bit of a light on it. And really, not to, like, I don't want to take any credit whatsoever from him, because he was always going to blow up and always do well. I think it was just maybe timing with it as well. And then, you know, I'm just so glad I decided to work with him on that third episode, because you know he's a great dude. He's a great dude that does great business, that grows great weed, and that's a really, 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 really rare thing. I mean, it's super rare.
Have you ever went to like create one of these documentaries on someone and like had an opinion on who they were going in, and then afterwards your opinion was like completely changed? You're like, this person is nothing like I thought the media kind of had portrayed him and this mystique that had been around them.
Yeah.
Or is it because you do such detailed research that hasn't been a moment for you?
No, I'm sure there has. I'm trying to think. Like, I'm like through. I think there's definitely a few. I think, you know, Quesada from the Backpack Boys was, you know, not like for like the media portrayed him anyway. I think it was fine. But, you know, I think didn't really know what to expect when I first talked to him. Amazing dude. Super nice. Down to earth. Quality guy. I think Burner, obviously, to a certain degree. It's funny, like people, a lot of people out there that are criticizing Burner, that hate Burner, whatever. But a lot of those people, when they talked it, if they were ever to talk to him in person, I'm sure they would change their tune right away. Because first of all, he's actually a very charismatic dude. He's a really smart guy. Don't ever, you know, underestimate. Just he's always a rapper. He's a front. No, he's that dude's smart as hell. Now, are there very valid criticisms of him? Absolutely. There are some. But I think you got to realize what people need to put in their mind is that this game and most businesses, but especially this one right now, it changes you. It changes you as an entrepreneur because it gets cutthroat. People do slimy shit to you. And then you have to kind of, I mean, I've seen it, you know, I kind of saw it through like, you know, interviewing Ivan for a number of hours and just kind of analyzing him. Like he's you know, great business, great person. You know, but he, you know, you have to be, I mean, all of these people at a certain level, they're all sharks, right? Some of those sharks are much more careful with how they, you know, they work with way less people, meaning they're gonna have a lot less exposure. But with Burner, right, he works, he has tons of partners, and that's just gonna leave you open for exposure. And inevitably there's gonna be a percentage of those deals that go bad, and then you have now enemies. And so Burner's done a lot of those deals, maybe to a detriment potentially. We'll see. Time will tell. But he's built up a lot of enemies through that as well. So, and he's also gotten, you know, recognition. You know, there's a bunch of aspects to it. But, and more so, I think it's funny with like the whole media portraying like that portion of your question. Because like, I think to a lot of the media portrayed Burner as this like amazing business, you know, like pretty well. I mean, honestly, I think, I'm not even gonna lie. I think the video, when I put that first video out, it was kind of just the start of him doing kind of his whole, you know, of mainstream cannabis, you know, more so mainstream media starting to talk about him and kind of, you know, look at him in a certain light. I think, like I said, I don't want to take anything away from Burner or anything, but I think that video that I put out, I think it helped him a ton in certain aspects. I know for a fact, for example, I was at a party in NYC and this guy walks up to me. It was at the Astro Club party. He goes, "Dude, I recognize you." And I was like, "Oh, did you watch my videos?" He goes, "Oh yeah, you're that dude. So I own the building where the Cookies, you know, NYC clothing store is, right? You know who that is, right? So his name is Michael. So yeah. The guy who owns that. A shout out to Michael, by the way. And he goes, "I saw your video about, you know, there's a portion in the video where I talk about how, you know, Cookies uses the clothing stores as expansion tools to go into markets before, you know, the regulatory system set up, or it's a good environment for you to open up." And they use, you know, the clothing stores as a mechanism to kind of get their name in that market, start to generate all that stuff. Anyway, he saw that and he was like, "Oh, I'm going to go hit up Burner and try to get, you know, tell him I have this space here in NYC. If you want to put your clothing store here, you know, we could figure out a deal." And that's exactly what happened. And shout out to Michael too. I really appreciate, you know, a lot of people don't really like to say those kind of, you know, some people don't for some reason. I mean, I always like to, you know, give credit where credit's due. Not credit to me or anything. Like, that's not what I mean more so, but just like, just be honest. Like, that's where I got the idea from. And then like, you know, that's how this happened. And it was just dope to hear, because that was the first time I'd ever heard like a directly, one of my videos directly leading to a deal. I'm sure that Burner and Cookie would have found another place, you know, somebody else, you know, that would have happened. But that's the thing about this kind of media, is it helps. It's a really efficient way to, first of all, network with people that are like-minded that maybe want to work with you. And, you know, they're coming to you rather than you having to go to them. Right. That's kind of the difference on that. But
there's not like a tangible ROI to that, like immediately, but it compounds over time. And that brand positioning, like he did, I mean, as good as you can, especially because its location, it was spectacular. So kind of taking it one step further, who's the white whale? Who's on the bucket list of people that you're like, this would be the number one person I would love to do a documentary on or a company?
It's a good question. It's a really good question. The thing is, dude, is I think that there's a lot like those bucket lists, those are stories I really want. I think I've done a lot of the ones that I really wanted to do, like right off the bat. I think there's definitely some people right now I could think off the top of my head that that would be awesome to do, you know, work with.
Who?
There's I've done the ones that I know I've wanted to do no matter what. Like I just do it, right? Like for the most part. Now a lot of the bucket list items, they're not going to be fully apparent to me until I do it, right? That's the thing. Like I just put out recently this like white boy Kev interview with, you know, him and talking about the New York, you know, Hayes and that era. And people love that interview. I love that interview too. And I didn't even realize it until I watched it again. And it was, you know, shout out to my editor, Sawyer. So I think I've done a lot of the, like, I mean, there's definitely people that are kind of in that like upper echelon of like cultural, you know, cannabis entrepreneurs that I would be interested to talk to. There's a couple of people, but it's like, it's kind of weird at this point. All of the front facing people are kind of, for the most part, I've done most of them, but there's people behind those people that I would love to talk about that I know, you know, I know it'd be a little bit more. I have to wait. Like there's a lot of these stories where I just have to just wait. That's a good question. I'm trying to think like someone that.
What about another industry?
Another industry?
Any industry. Yeah. Just any white whale.
Absolutely. I would absolutely love to do a story on like, you know, first of all, you know, Ghazi, but do like a real, not like a mainstream media, like PR puff piece, but like a real, like, that's kind of like what people want to see. Like, that's the thing I would like to do with, you know, show them the real, really. But Ghazi, who started Empire, Money Man, who's signed to Empire, Gucci Mane. These are people that like I grew up listening to. Like Gucci Mane is someone for sure. Young Scooter, a couple of different people. I'm gonna be actually in Atlanta pretty soon, but I definitely want to do some music artists for sure. But I want, because I think I can really do it in a whole different way than anybody else has done it. And I've taken a lot of inspiration for these formats, for everything from the music industry media. Like, you know, if people watch, you know, different, you know, personalities or different shows on YouTube that are, you know, around hip hop, they'll, you know, and then they start to watch my videos, they'll understand like the influences from, you know, different people, for sure. They've influenced my, you know, content. But I think just as time has gone on, I've kind of realized like I'm pretty good at telling people stories. And this is something I've just kind of, you know, I've practiced it for sure. And I've gotten, you know, better and better as time goes on. But I think I've gotten pretty good about humanizing people and really understanding where the pinpoints to talk about. And I would like to take that to, I'm always going to be doing cannabis stuff no matter what. I mean, this is like my, you know, my passion. This is something I love. This is something that you know, I always will be doing. But I definitely want to take, you know, like, you know, I have a couple, you know, number of different channels. I got like the Luke channel. It's just like L-U-C, my first name. I want to start to do more documentaries on, you know, different entrepreneurs that really got it out the mud, that really started from nothing. And not necessarily that, but like they were a small business and they worked their way up, and just analyzing that success in a interesting way. Because I think, you know, there's a lot of value. There's a lot of, it's like three birds, one stone, right? That person gets their story told. The audience gets information. They get the education. They get the education and the analysis by, you know, us looking at that story. Right. And then, you know, for myself, I get to learn. The thing I also realized too is with media, you know, and I'm sure you guys would say the same thing, is I get to learn myself by doing the media, right? When I interview people. So plus I'm networking, right? Plus we're networking right now, but we're also creating content. But there's a lot. I mean, I'm trying to think too. I mean, there's a ton of stories I want to tell. I mean, there's some stories here in Seattle I would love to talk about. I'm probably gonna do. It's just, I've been trying to figure out the business of it all so I can scale it up. I figured out certain aspects of the business, but, you know, I really want to scale this up and turn this into, you know, allow for me to go into, you know, have my LMC, the High Design, you know, those brands, you know, stick with cannabis, you know, maybe go into potentially psychedelics in the future a little bit, but, you know, then move into like, you know, creating similar type brands, but in different spaces. because I have a lot of interest, and I you know, I'm a political junkie. I'm interested in a lot of things, but I realized, and you know, I'm a big believer in fate, you know, Fortuna, the goddess of Fortuna. You know, I didn't plan on going back into cannabis after I lost everything when I was 22, right? It literally, the only job I could get was a retail job, or not a retail job, a legal regulated I-502 brand in space, weed, and can genesis. Like literally, that's the only job I could get. And then that led to this and this. So like the fact that I'm doing this now, it's like, I would have never thought that, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, but you know, it's really generated this love for storytelling.
Do you have any takes on the cannabis industry that are different than most would agree with?
Now, give me what's like the, like, give me an example, like, let's say like a,
an example for most would be, this is an easy one, that MSOs grow shitty weed. Most would agree that they grow shitty weed, but maybe you feel slightly differently. That would just be an example.
The thing about it though, is like, this is it. This is the thing you need to realize. Like, MSOs grow shitty weed, but even if they grow great weed, they still grow shitty weed, if that makes sense.
They have shitty brands.
Shitty brands. It's the representation. It's how does the person feel? What's the emotion? Everyone's buying on emotion, right? You could have literally two different, you know, like the same exact weed, let's say, when there are two different brands. And because there's an emotional tie, they understand the history behind it. They understand all these things we're talking about, you know, we just talked about. They're going to be like, oh, this is fire. And then let's say we give that same exact batch, that same, you know, an eighth of that same exact batch. We put it in a MSO jar, give it to them 2 months later, and they're like, oh, this is shit. I guarantee you there's a portion of people that do that. Now there's obviously the general consumer that can just who cares? They don't even like look at that kind of stuff. But as time goes on, we're getting more and more brand centric, right? Brand is, you know, brand, that buzzword, brand. And there's so much media, there's so much content, and we're all consuming at such high levels on, you know, on our phones all day. We're learning about these brands, and you know, there's enough time, like there's like you need to tell your story because everyone is looking online, and there are so many people out there that to not tell your story would be it would hurt you, because we're constantly on our phones, and you know, it's a missed opportunity in a lot of ways.
I was thinking about this the other day, right? And like, I think one of the biggest issues with the cannabis industry is the fact that you had a bunch of big public companies come in and just try to build the factory for a brand, right? And if you look at like any other major brand, right? Let's just take Coca-Cola, for example, right? Like Coca-Cola started in a garage 100 years ago, and it took Coca-Cola 100 years to get to what they are now. And like you hear these CEOs of these publicly traded companies that are like, I want to be the Coca-Cola, where they're like, all right, well, you should literally follow Coca-Cola's business model, which means that for the first 30 years, you should probably be making it in a garage, right? So it's crazy that you see this massive disconnect in the industry.
That's such a good point you made. And that was such a great parallelism there, because you're absolutely right. That's exactly right. And that's why there has been so much grinding and like, you know, conflict between the two, like the corporate, the culture, right? And there's going to continue to be a lot in like, you know, increasingly so, because there's going to be people going out of business, right, from the culture side. But you're absolutely right. It's so weird. There's a culture that's been underground, right, for what, 90 years, 80 years, and that's been developing. It's been growing. It's rich. I literally grew up in the Seattle cannabis culture. Like I was a baby of it, pretty much. Like literally I was spoiled with this shit, right? Like, you know, I got a medical card, walk into markets, you can get anything you want. I got, you know, growers all over the place that are, you know, like I literally have growers that I used to buy from that, you know, I would work with that like saw me grow up like, from like 15 on to like, you know, to now. And they like, you know, I meet their whole family, and like, you know, it's crazy. Like, and there's people like that on the West Coast, but people like that all over the country for sure. But that is serious. There's generations of growers, of, you know, people that have really invested time in this plant. And for the government to now come in and say, okay, these people, you're not gonna be able to participate because, you know, you're not gonna be able to adapt. You know, this is the whole thing, is that the trappers, the traditional market folks, is another reason why I started my YouTube channel. You have to adapt now, because what's going to happen is, like, you know, they're going to view you as, you know, you have to learn how to do business on quote unquote their, not to say their terms, but the legal corporate, you know, their terms. Like you have to understand how they're doing it to be able to play, because that's the future of this, right? But at the same time, you know,
having a bunch of people that never cared about this plant in the first place, never took risks, never really, you know, they just go cha-ching, right? That right there is very short-sighted. It's also stupid because if you're trying to actually make real, like if you're trying to, if you are really indeed there, your end goal to make money, which is most people, like almost everyone, right? Going about it in a way where it's like, you know, I'm just going to take it like I, you know, I bulldozed over this industry over here, you know, I just bulldozed them over with just, you know, just business tactics, all this. It's stupid, bro. There's a lot of nuances in this game that I think people don't understand when it comes to the media landscape, the understanding of the culture. There are some, though. There's a few of these people that aren't really from cannabis that are sly. They're right now, they're kind of going under the radar. You know, they're smart to do that, honestly, for the time being, kind of learn. But, you know, it's like you said, though, it's like you've now got these, like, imagine this. What if like there's hundreds of these people, hundreds of different cokes, right? They're all in their garage. They've been doing it for 30, 40, 50 years. Maybe they've done it with their father and their grandpa. And then let's say the government comes in and says, okay, guys, we're going to let this car manufacturing company come in and start, you know, taking over your industry. That's probably not the best example, but somebody else that didn't have that time. And it's like, well, we have all the expertise. We know what to do. We've been building this. It's just, you know, we don't have the capital and we don't necessarily know how to operate in these new kind of times of Wall Street. Of, you know, these complex financial markets that are really in a lot of ways, you know, overly complicated. A lot of it's just gambling, it's bets on bets, it's derivative, you know, it's stuff that, you know, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors too. I mean, to be honest.
I slightly disagree. And here's why. Brands matter, and I'm in agreement, but in certain states, brands don't matter as much. And that's because the way they've positioned these assets of being limited capture states, MSOs are like the infrastructure, in my opinion, in certain states that are extremely limited. And their best future is to come in, or their current future is to come in and to limit the competitors, which everyone can agree with is not the best. But those brands are not as valuable in those states today because there's limited opportunities to purchase. But in the future, brands will be the differentiator. And I think the MSOs will go back into the infrastructure like a Target or a CVS versus like them trying to, quote unquote, come out as brand. The only reason I think they come out as a brand now is because they're forced to. And I think they prefer to be more infrastructure based than brand focus based. Or at least some.
I'm with you there. I mean, that's one of the big things that I talk about and that I despise, honestly, is, you know, these different states that have absolutely rigged the game. I mean, almost every single state has been rigged to a certain degree, right? But there's more so than others. And like you said, I remember the first thing we talked about on Twitter, you know, that's just part of the game, right? You got to play the game. But
We're not making the rules.
And I just personally, like, my whole, like, goal in life, and really, like, my long-term goal is to get money out of politics. I know that's, you know, I want to play a small part in that because that's, in my opinion, I don't get mad at corporate. I get mad at these politicians that are, you know, legally bribed, right? Or sometimes, you know, not. And but you're right. The whole game right now is limit competition, destroy the small business, right? This is what, you know, big business has done, you know, other places around the world. I mean, it's like, you know, divide and conquer. Don't let people allow for, you know, big business to dominate by just influencing the politicians. Take over the infrastructure, really. And at the end of the day, you're right. I mean, that's what's going to happen in a lot of ways, right? Like the smart ones, the smart MSOs, they're going to be building their infrastructure and then they're going to start to incorporate the culture brands that made it. That's just what's going to happen. It's starting to happen in Florida. Let's be honest with Trulieve. Let's just be real. Like they've signed what? That's the smartest move. I mean, Trulieve, I've got some, definitely got some criticisms of them for sure. If you look into the whole history, if you watch the video, how the corruption works in the cannabis industry, the last story, we featured three stories. The last story is about Kim Rivers, right? Now, you know, I'm like I said, but at the same time, from a MSO executive standpoint and playing the game, she's doing a good job. She understands what she needs to do. She needs to get people from the culture on her side, meaning she needs to sign these people. She needs to have some sort of economic leverage over them, right? I mean, I've been now hit up, like there's times where I talk a little bit about Kim Rivers, right? And I've been hit up by, you know, culture people like, hey, you know, trying to like, no, like, you know, protection, right? So these MSOs also need to realize like it's protection in other ways too. You're going to have big people kind of going to bat for you because, you know, it lines their pockets. Now, is that kind of a sellout move of some of these people? Potentially, yeah, for sure. But it's also, this is a business, right? This is people got to survive. And it's like, you know, for people like the hardliners of like, you sold out, man. You know, it's like, I think you need to have your set core principles and just always stay true to those now. But there's a lot of things besides that, though. There's a lot of things that are moving. And if you can stay, you know, true to your core principles, you know, whatever they may be, I think you're going to, I think, you know, you're in the right for the most part. Right. I think it's also, this is the playbook, right? This is what I've been telling people for a while. I've always been talking about these different business models that work for the small guy, like the little guy. And it is building brand, right? It's building either proprietary technology and, you know, inventing something, right? You know, SOPs, but that's kind of being flooded everywhere. So it's becoming less and less valuable. But the brand, right? The brand equity, that is something, because I always say like this, like imagine this day where you're going to be sitting across the table and there's an MSO, a big money person. And they're like, there's two ways that this can go. They're going to either slide you a check for, you know, liquid, like pennies on the dollar, take this, or we're just going to, you know, you can just die out and you're, you know, you're already struggling. So you're going to have to take that, and, you know, you're going to, you know, not make really anything on it. Right. Or you're going to be sitting across the table from those big money people. And even if they have billions of dollars, right, they can't go and they can spend as much money as they want on building their own brand and their brand equity. But that's still, you know, that's still something that they can't necessarily just go out and buy. It takes time. It takes, you know, authenticity. That's the thing that a $1 billion company doesn't have over you. You can build brand equity, you know, bootstrap it, grassroots, and you can build this into something where you're, you know, the big money people, you're going to have leverage in those negotiations. And that's the key. Think about that end day for all the small business owners out there, for the most part, right? There's going to be a few that are going to go on to be like the, you know, the sharks or like the bigger fish, right? That are going to actually be like acquiring people themselves. But think about that day where you're sitting across the table and it's like, are you going to have leverage or are you not? Are you going to have some money for your kids and their kids? Or are you going to have everything pretty much, you know, you're going to lose everything. And a lot of people, they're going to lose everything because they're not understanding where this is all going, where this is inevitably going to happen. You know, you've got to be educated in this stuff. If you are right now a small business owner, you're going into outdoor cultivation and there's nothing else you're adding. You're not trying to build brand necessarily. You're kind of just being one of those. You are going to 100% go out of business in like, at this point, it's going quicker and quicker and quicker, right? You need to be different. You need to have a unique offering. You need to create a tribe and a group of people that are behind your brand. They're, because brand, like brand equity is really brand loyalty. That's the key. Brand loyalty translates into brand equity. And that's one of the few things that you're going to have leverage over these $1 billion companies. It's going to be brand equity. But it's hard to do, though. It's really hard to do. There's also other ways, you know, like I said, technology, genetics, definitely. But genetics is also branding, too. It's another component to branding, right? So it's brand equity is the big, I mean, you know, it's the big play, in my opinion, for the small business entrepreneur.
And I think that one of the issues that Brian brought up in terms of like MSOs being forced into brands, right? I think that it all stems from like other industries. If you go start a brand, there is a playbook, right? You're like, okay, I call a factory. I have them do my custom recipe. I choose my label. I fight with them about my packaging and where it's going to be stored. And then I have my product and I reach out to this massive retail network that is the United States capital system. And I get these big box stores to buy it, right? And when these big MSOs who are used to playing those games came into the cannabis space and they were like, oh, we'll just call a factory. And they're like, well, that doesn't exist, right? And they're like, well, like, I guess they'll just build one. So like I think that it's like kind of a chicken before the egg kind of situation in terms of like how that whole thing work. And they'll build their infrastructure and hopefully they are smart enough to be able to have it be flexible so that different brands can come in with different requirements that they need to be met for their products, right? So that consumers end up with a product in that brand's package that is truly representative of what they've spent the last X amount of time cultivating in their garage, right? That's the hope, right?
They've taken risks also, right? And like, and this is me by no means defending them. Just saying is that everyone here is fighting to kind of grow and navigate the rules and the complexities. And some people have been forced to do certain things and others like here. And while at the end of the day, we all know how it'll shake out is people will rely on what they're best at and those will rise to the top and then will connect. And unfortunately, we will see a big shakeout over the next 10 years, but those relationships are going to run deep. And eventually they'll kind of marry in together where the brands and the companies will come together as one. And sure, I understand the leverage standpoint, how that all works. But if we're going to be totally honest, the bigger fish on the outside industry, the big CPG companies, the tobacco companies, the alcohol companies, all those boys are coming in town. And it's just a matter of time, pharmaceuticals, before they come and disrupt everybody and push even the MSOs to the quote unquote small pond.
100%. The MSOs are really like medium sized fish.
They're tiny. Yeah.
They're tiny. People need to realize like the big money has not even entered the room yet. Like not even close. Like
not publicly at least.
Yeah, like up in Canada, you know, there was all like a little bit of that happening. But no, but like the real, and they've been, I mean, I know these are people, these are companies that have invested, they have, you know, they've got contracted out different, you know, groups, different individuals to like start doing the groundwork. You think that these big, big money people haven't put years of infrastructure and groundwork into entering this at the right time? Some of them have, absolutely. And I mean, like I've been contacted by some of these people. It's kind of creepy. They're like, we can't tell you who we're representing, but like weird shit like that, right? And so... But going back to the point, I guess is like, yeah, the industry is being made in real time. And that's the thing I always love is like, you know, what we're doing here, there's no one that really came before us doing this. We are the ones writing, you know, we're really the first generation of legal, like, you know, that's in this new environment of the digital era, which is also another crazy aspect to it. But, yeah, no one's gonna know how this is gonna shake up, and it's you're right. I think as time goes on, progresses, the best in each sector are gonna survive and eventually fuse together. And yeah, the playbook is different here. I mean, it's what kind of consumer agricultural good has been legalized recently that has a massive supporting culture of it that is being now legalized in the digital social media era. Nothing really. There's nothing even close to it necessarily, really.
And one that is grown in all the states, because of course we grow oranges in all the states as well.
Yeah, 100%. And it's like, so it's fascinating because it's going to be, I mean, right now what's interesting is right now we're going to see the different laboratories of democracy, you know, go on. And really what we're seeing really is just a petri dish for corruption. I mean, you're telling all these small, like these small politicians, like these small, you know, governing, you know, counties or states, even, you know, you're telling them they're going to have the power to get to pick winners and losers. And you think they're not going to be corruption in every aspect, every single state there is. I mean, it's rampant. It is one of the most, I mean, it's just a showcase of our time though. And that's why I love cannabis, because it's now being brought into the light, it's being legalized. And so I get to, like I said, I'm interested in a lot of different things. But I love to use cannabis as a lens to look at these broader issues in our world today. And corruption is one of the biggest ones. I mean, it's massive. I mean, big business. I mean, like I said, I'm a capitalist for sure. But I think, let's be honest, it's gotten out of hand. There's a little too, like the fact that pharma, the military contractors, and the energy industry, the fact that those three big, you know, like industries, I mean, they run Washington. They run our world. Let's be honest. Ever since Citizens United and then, you know, Buckley, all those different bills, I mean, it's gotten out of hand a little bit. But it's just, you know, but this is why I love cannabis. And I love, because there's a strong culture here in cannabis. And so we're fighting back, right? We're fighting back. We're showcasing these people. It's not going to be that easy, right? I mean, you know, eventually, you know, it's, you know, there's going to be a fusing between the two, right? But look at California. If you're going to be corrupt, if you're going to pick losers and winners, you know, if you're going to do terror, if you're going to try to kill the competition through high taxation, black market's winning, baby. Still, to this day, 2-3 times the size of the legal market. And it doesn't, like, I mean, it just seems like a quagmire there. They're just, I mean, yeah, there are definitely people, you know, because the price of the pound has gone down significantly, you know, there is people that are, you know, leaving that profession, right? But still. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. We're still. I mean, we're really in like the third inning of this overall
maybe
saturation.
Maybe
even like, yeah. And it's like,
we don't even have all the states online.
No, I know. But the thing about the states online, and this is another thing about the states online, is like, I mean, it's if I would know for sure, let's say I'm in Idaho and I want to start a cannabis business for sure in Idaho, I'm going to be real pissed because I know I'm probably going to be the very last state. I'm probably not even going to get legalized there, they're probably going to be forced by like what they did in Idaho with the drinking age, right? From 18 to 21, because, you know, the federal government wants to have continuity around the, so they're like, oh, we're going to pull the federal funding unless you do this, right? That's probably the case for them. And so, but if you're trying to have a business in Idaho, and there better be protections for that market, which Montana did, but for the bigger markets, you know, that are going to be last, you know, there probably won't be protection for that. And so what's going to happen is you're going to see kind of a smaller form of like neoliberalism. Like, we do a lot of neoliberalism in terms of the international space, where big American companies come into these small countries, you know, and, you know, America forces, you know, gives them a loan or whatever, makes them, you know, drop all of their protectionism, right? They want free trade. And then a big corporation comes in and just cleans house and destroys the local economy there. I mean, that's what's going to happen to some of these people in some of these states that are going to come online later. Also, the fact is, I mean, in my opinion, but, you know, when I consult with different companies and other things, I'm not saying necessarily do this, but I'm saying, you know, look at what fake packaging is. Looking at like, there's two different approaches to, you know, there's two different markets for this brand. Well, I don't like I don't like to see Glass House doing what they're doing. That's what everyone else is doing too, though. They're having their two different systems. They've got their legal, and they've got their traditional, and they've got kind of two different systems. The thing I don't like about Glass House is they're just continuous, like, because they're stuck in this business model of what they've done with the investors, because they have investors, they're stuck to that model. They're trying to expand the amount of greenhouse space, which I think is just, come on, like, you're trying to run up score, but it's the game, you know, it's whatever. And it's also the fact is, like, if the California government's going to, you know, say, you know, we're going to shut down the small grower, but not that's my big thing that I get mad about, right? That's about it. But at the end of the day, like, backdooring is the thing that you have to do in the industry, especially in California, right? But it also, from a expansion standpoint, you know, it's an opportunity for brands to get their name and, you know, bubbling through the streets, right? If you watch some of my different videos, there's different videos kind of talking about that, right? You can utilize, I'm not saying you should necessarily, right? Wink, wink, but, like, you know, there's different ways to legally do it. Like, people at this point just send their packaging out to different states. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's kind of, I don't like that necessarily, but people are playing this game at so many different levels. And you got to realize people don't play by the rules. No, a lot of people don't. Now, is it? Yeah. I mean, yeah, for the most part. So.
I mean, everyone's got to eat, you know what I mean? And, like, if you're forcing a rock in a hard place, like, you're going to do what you have to do to eat. And unfortunately, the system that has been created to facilitate the launch of this industry has just been a sideways train wreck dumpster fire. So people have literally been like, all right, well, like, I'm not going to play by your rules, because then I don't get to eat and I starve and my kid doesn't get to eat either. So, like, I'm going to do what I have to do to feed my family. And that's what, unfortunately, has kind of been this, like, flashpoint within the industry, especially in states like California, where you've had people up in Humboldt that are third generation growers, and now they literally can't even utilize any of those skill sets that they've had passed on through generations, because there's just no way they can make money in it. It's insane to me.
It is insane. It's sad. I mean, it's not to get darker, but I mean, if you're gonna look, like, trust me, we're just seeing it right now. If you look at the suicide rate right now of farmers, just small town farm, I mean, it's going up a little dark, but this is a reality. I also think, like, for example, with like with Glass House, you know, maybe it's not in their business model necessarily, but I think that if they're, you know, they've got so much greenhouse space, why not take one of those million square feet greenhouses, split it up, and then hire all those people in Humboldt,
like an incubator,
but then working on all these craft brands, and, you know, do a good fair deal with them, and do what we're saying, like, let that big company adopt some of the culture, the expertise, all that. Are they going to do that? Probably not. But hey, I'm trying to be a problem solver here. Solutions, you know?
I mean, I love it. We can tag Graham in the clip too. So I think that's the perfect way to end, Luke. So for our listeners, they want to get in touch, they want to watch some of your documentaries, where can they find you?
Yeah. So really, just if you go onto YouTube and you just type in LMC, I'll pop up, you know, first right away. But I do really, you know, advise people to go to the very beginning of my, you know, I had 1,000+ videos. Like I said, I took all of those down from my main channel. I really try to keep now, you know, important stories that I think, you know, hold true and are, you know, you can learn, I think, something from every single video I've done. And there also is, you know, I think it also pertains to
today, right? And what's going on today. So I do, you know, say start from the beginning if you can. But yeah, go to LMC. It's the High Design documentary series. It's kind of more of my like current kind of analysis slash a little bit of history, obviously, but of these different entrepreneurs that are operating today. I've got the Trap Tree series, which is kind of, you know, celebrating, you know, preserving is a huge component of this, and acknowledging, you know, all these OG smugglers and trappers that, you know, took a lot of risk and helped build this market that now we are operating in today. People need to realize that there's people that came before us that went to jail, died. I have friends that have died off this, right? And it's like, these are sacrifices that people have made to build the market that we now have today, you know, from the culture. And so, you know, it's important for, you know, I think to remember those people. And, you know, I know some of the people may have been not the best people, but I try to cover really just people that, you know, helps expand the cannabis movement. You know, I talk a little bit here and there about other, you know, because there's kind of overlap. There's people that sell blow or sell hair, you know, all that stuff. I try to stay away from those people, but there's a couple of stories like that. But so there's Trap Tree series. And then I have a High Design history series, which kind of just talks about like, you know, general history in different regards. And then, yeah, if you want to follow me on Instagram, lmc.media on Instagram or lmc.luke. Yeah. And just if you go to my, if you just look up LMC High Design on Google, you'll see my website and you can find all the different links there. But if you want to reach out, you know, the best way typically I have six different Instagrams because I'm just trying to diversify. So if one gets taken down, I can still keep it going. So I have so many DMs because of that, and it's hard to kind of go through all of them. So the best way to get a hold of me definitely is to send me an email at highdesignbusiness@gmail.com. Definitely the best way.
We'll link it all up in the show notes. Thanks for taking the time. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you guys. This was amazing. I really, really, really love this conversation.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hi, it's Justin Benton, host of the Miracle Plant Podcast, where we discuss this miracle plant that goes by so many names and how it's helping people in so many extraordinary ways. So if you love this plant and you want to hear a story that tugs on those heartstrings and learn more about this plant, then head on over to the Miracle Plant Podcast. You'll be glad you did.